Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon so that you can call in and we can discuss the questions you may have about the Bible or the Christian faith, or the disagreements you may have with the host. Feel free to call. We'll be glad to talk to you. We have some lines open as I speak, and you can reach me at this number, 844-484-5737. That number again is 844-484-5737. Our first callers, our two first callers, are both from British Columbia, Canada. First is Kevin from Vancouver. Kevin, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question of Isaiah 53, verse 10.
Okay.
Now, this has been on my mind for many years. I've asked many people and even a Hebrew scholar. And I was wondering about the when it talks about he will see of his offspring and prolong his days. And I was wondering, can that he refer to not Jesus but the Father? Because
that
to
is,
me...
Yeah. That is ambiguous because many times...
Okay.
Yeah, many times he is given without a very clear antecedent. Of course, the one being described generally in the passage is the Messiah, but there are things said about him that have to do with God. So, you know, it is possible it's saying God, you know, will see his offspring, meaning he'll see Christ, his offspring, on the cross. And he will prolong his days, meaning he'll resurrect him from the dead.
Right.
Those are very possible ways to read that. Now, it's also possible that he refers to the Messiah himself. He shall see his offspring would mean that he will eventually be, you know, he'll have us, his family. You know, he'll see those who are the products of his suffering. You know, the offspring of God who are his you know, his offspring, as it were, through him, and that he will prolong his days, meaning the Messiah will prolong his own days. But I think very probably this is referring to God the Father. He will see his offspring, which I suspect is the Messiah. Certainly the chapter is about the Messiah, but as far as the he and the his and so forth, those things are a little more ambiguous. But The two ways to take it, I would favor the suggestion that God will see Christ, his offspring, and God will prolong his, that is, Christ's days through resurrection. That's my
okay.
understanding of that.
Mm-hmm.
But acknowledging that the word he could refer back to the Messiah himself.
Right.
Less easily.
Right, right. Yeah, because to me the inference is, It applies to both the see and the prolong. And so if it was Messiah, he can't really prolong. Well, I guess, yeah, you're right, he could. Well, that's very good. That's the first I've heard someone say that it could be both.
Well, I think
that,
it could be
really,
both. I think it could
right.
be both. Which way do you lean? Because I lean toward it referring to God.
Absolutely to the Father. This is the thing.
Yeah.
I'm hearing the opposite. No, it's the Son. But to me, it says he will see his Son. And that's just an amazing proclamation of what's to come. Isaiah
yeah.
53 is just such an amazing chapter.
It is a fantastic
on its own. But
true.
This just even makes it more, to me, I lean towards, yeah, the Father will see his offspring. And the Father will prolong his days, bring him back to life. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yes.
And this, you know, and it says in verse 11, he shall see the travail of his soul and be satisfied. That makes me think it's talking about he, the Father, shall see the travail of his, that is Christ's soul. And the Father
right.
will be satisfied through what Christ has done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is such an amazing... I use Isaiah 53. I've actually shared that with a couple of Jewish people. And this is in the Tanakh, you know.
Yeah. You know, I heard a friend of mine back in the 70s was witnessing to a Jewish girl. And she didn't know the Bible much at all, but he said, well, let me read you a passage from the Bible, and you tell me who it's talking about. He read Isaiah 53, and he said, well, who do you think that's describing? And she said, well, that's obviously talking about Jesus, but we Jews don't accept the New Testament. she had no idea that was an Old Testament passage.
Great. That's incredible, eh?
Yeah, it sounds New Testament. All right, brother. Mm-hmm. I appreciate your call and your
thank you
thoughts.
So much. Take care, and God bless you and your ministry.
All right, Kevin. Same thing. God bless. Okay, another caller from British Columbia, Derek from Vancouver Island. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call today. I'm going through Matthew 24, Olivet Discourse, and I'm endeavoring to map it up with the book of Revelation, and I was hoping you could kind of help me with that.
Well, I don't think there's a passage by passage correspondence between the Olivet Discourse and Revelation. I think they are both discussing the same thing, but I don't think that they're passing through the material, side by side. In other words, I don't think you could do verses in Matthew 24 and say, okay, those parallel with these two chapters in Revelation. Then the next verse parallels with the next chapter in Revelation, that kind of thing. There's simply themes in both books talking about the same thing, in my opinion. But, I would not be able to, I've never done that kind of analysis. We're going through and saying, okay, which verses in Revelation talk about the same things as which verses in the Olivet Discourse. I don't know. There probably are people who've done that, but I've never been interested in doing that myself.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was just seeing, even chunk by chunk, if I can relate it. But Matthew 24 seems like Jesus starts with a big picture synopsis, and then he says, meanwhile, back at the temple, and then goes through some more things. And it seems like Revelation seems to do that, too. It's like, I'm going to discuss this for a while, but then I'm cutting back to discuss in more detail the following thing.
I would agree that in Revelation, a lot of the visions do cut back to earlier points. I believe it's a very common view. It's not unanimously held, but it's a very common view that Revelation divides into seven subunits. And I can pretty much tell you what the perimeters of those are. But people see these units differently from each other. Some see it as a great play. Like a Greek play cut up into seven scenes or acts, seven acts. And then sometimes they say each act has seven scenes. So some people analyze it down to that kind of detail. But they don't do the same thing with the Olivet Discourse, although most of those people would agree that the Olivet Discourse probably is talking about the same thing. It's just that these are different passages that talk about the same thing differently, just like you would find in Daniel, different visions talk about the same period of time. Nebuchadnezzar's vision of the metals in the image represent the same period of time as Daniel's dream in chapter 7 of the four beasts that come out of the sea. These are just they make different points about the same thing, and I think Revelation and the Olivet Discourse do that too. So I wouldn't. It'd be quite a job to try to line them up, and I'm not sure that it could be done without some artificiality.
Right, okay. I thank you. I was hoping I could kind of cheat on the task and get if you have done it before, but I guess that's in my realm to try and figure that out on my own.
Right now.
Go ahead. Oh, yeah, I was going to switch bases a quick sec to Daniel 9, verse 25. And this is just something also I've been thinking about. But the angel cut it into, a chunk of 7 weeks and then a chunk of 62 weeks. Do you know why, maybe? And is there something significant to the first 7 weeks and then, the 62 next weeks? Why the angel would have done that?
There's no obvious reason that all readers would be compelled to agree about. The breaking it up into the 7 weeks and the 62 weeks would be seen. The 7 weeks would represent, some feel, the period of time of the rebuilding of the temple and of the city of Jerusalem after Zerubbabel's time and through Nehemiah and Ezra. Now, I don't know that we could say it was literally a 49 years, because I'm not sure where it actually begins or where it would be thought to end, but it's the shorter period within a bigger period. It was, the whole period is 70 weeks, meaning 70 times 7 years, 490 years. The smaller segment within it is about the rebuilding of the city after the Babylonian exile. Probably the 62 weeks then represents the period between the rebuilding of the city by the exiles until the Messiah comes. And then the last week would be related to the Messiah. So that's how I would see the breakup.
Yeah, and you'd said in verse 26 then the people of the prince who is to come, that speaks about not Jesus, but the Roman, maybe Titus or something?
In my opinion, mm-hmm. The prince is to come is related to Rome, but some people believe it's Christ because Messiah was called the prince in an earlier verse. I mean, some have that view. Yeah.
Now, what do you think about that view? I know it says shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, the people that come do that. And it's like the Jews didn't do that, but
right.
They kind of did because they brought that on themselves.
Yeah, but I think
we could say
you've destroyed yourself by your bad behavior. You've ruined your life by committing crimes that end up with you being put in jail for life. You ruined your life. But the people who actually executed the criminal penalties are someone else. And I think the way it's worded, it points more to the ones who are bringing the destruction actively.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, true, in one sense, the Jews did bring it upon themselves. But I guess my instincts would not incline me to think that that's how it's saying it there. But I do know others who have said that it could be a reference to Christ and his people. But his people then could mean the Romans. After all, the parable of the wedding feast in Matthew 22, when the Jews reject the invitation of the wedding feast, the king sends out his armies and destroys their city, which is the Roman armies coming and destroying Jerusalem. And the Romans are there called his armies, you know. So, so in a sense, God's armies did come and do that. But again, I don't know if I'd say they're Jesus's armies. I mean, they could be. I just don't think that's necessary. The prince that is to come probably refers to the principality of the Romans, just as chapter 10 of Daniel talks about the principality of the Grecians and the Persians, you know, the prince of Persia and the prince of Grecia, and then there's the prince of the Roman Empire. These are the successive empires coming. And so I think maybe he's thinking of it that kind of a prince. You know, the Romans came and did that, and that's the work of the prince that was to come. But he's, of course, he has not yet in chapter 9 introduced these other princes, but in the next chapter he talks about the principality of Persia. Prince and principality are the same word. So the prince of Persia is a demonic power, I believe, over the Persian Empire. The principality of Grecia is also mentioned, which would be the principality over the Grecian Empire. And then the prince that is to come that will destroy the sanctuary would be the Roman one. But
right.
Obviously, there's different ways that can be taken, and I don't really feel a compulsion to decide among them. I have my own opinions and my leanings, but I don't feel compelled to insist upon one of them.
Thank you. You know, you allowed me to actually ask you three questions, so I don't want to take other people's time.
I'd better get someone out.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Derek, good talking to you.
Take care.
Thank you.
God bless. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye now. All right, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. If you'd like to be on the program, the number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Brittany calling from Antelope, California. Hi, Brittany. Welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, what does Ecclesiastes 7:11-12 mean when it says that money is a shelter and wisdom preserves those who have knowledge? Does the Bible say in 1 Timothy 6:10 that and the love of money is the root of all evil, and knowledge without Christ is useless in James 1:5? I'm just trying to figure out what the relevance is to the modern context and what's the whole meaning.
Yeah, Paul is talking about your morality and spiritual issues, and that all forms of evil arise from the love of money, which is covetousness or greed. Greed is what he's saying, where he says all kinds of evil. It's the root of all kinds of evil. Every kind of evil can be at times, in certain instances, traced back to the love of money. Idolatry is said to be covetousness in Ephesians and Colossians. Dishonoring your parents can be done for the love of money. You don't want to share your money with them. Jesus rebuked the Pharisees for that in Matthew 15. Murder, it has certainly often been done for money. Adultery has certainly been done for money as well. Stealing certainly has been done for the love of money. Bearing false witness in court, that's been done for the love of money. You know, people have paid false witnesses. We have instances of that when Jesus was on trial and when Stephen was on trial. So, I mean, the Bible actually records many instances where various commandments of God have been violated by the same motivation, which is the love of money. Now, Solomon is not advocating the love of money in Ecclesiastes. He's observing. Now, this is what the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes do. They observe things. They observe tendencies and principles and generalities in the world. And Solomon does in Ecclesiastes mention that money is something that provides shelter for certain people, even in a bad way. It can. I mean, a person who's rich can bribe authorities to get his political way. A court may let a rich criminal off because he's rich and influential, and where he wouldn't if the same person was not rich. So Solomon says that money provides a shelter for people. He's not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. He's simply saying that is simply a fact. In Proverbs, I think he says a rich man's wealth is his a strong tower, meaning his strong defense. Money does provide immunity for many people in many situations. This is not the Bible teaching that that's how it should be. It's just an observation of how it actually is. So Solomon's doing something very different from what Paul is doing. Proverbs is a philosophy based on observation. It's not really laying out morals or ethics or spiritual values, although they come in occasionally as separate issues. But for the most part, both Proverbs and Ecclesiastes are observing things that are just true about life. In Ecclesiastes, many of the things that he's observing, he's observing them with distaste and disapproval. If you read through Ecclesiastes, he says, I saw this happen, I saw that happen, I realized that that's all vanity. And I saw this and that and the other thing, and that's all vanity too. It's all emptiness. In fact, that's the most common thing he says in Ecclesiastes. It's all vanity. And so, the idea is a rich man, like Solomon was. Solomon was a rich man. He's a rich king. A rich man, you know, his riches seem to provide him some level of immunity, but in the end, it's all vain to be rich. You know, it's there's no great meaning in it. There's no great value in being rich. Yeah, maybe it's people desire it because they can buy their money, buy themselves out of certain kinds of troubles. But in the end, pursuing after money is vanity. That's what he says numerous times. So he's making a different kind of point than Paul is.
Okay, and then the whole idea with what Solomon says too with this is with wisdom preserving those who have knowledge, does that include people trying to be extra concerned with academic affairs, or is there some other contextual?
Are you thinking of verse 12?
Yeah, verse 12.
For wisdom is a defense, as money is a defense, but the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. I think what he's saying there is there's various ways to come out on top of things in a conflict. One is if you got a lot of money. Another is if you're sharp. If you got wisdom, if you've got cleverness. You can, for example, even in a court of law, you know, if you're clever, you might be able to get your way because you're, yeah, you've got some wit and some wisdom and so forth, and you can persuade people of something even when you're in the wrong. Now, he's not saying the man of wisdom is in the wrong. He's simply saying there are certain things that make a man, that are desirable in the worldly eyes because of the advantage they give to you. And certainly money and wisdom are two of those things. Jeremiah brings those two things together along with a third thing, which is might, and indicates that people tend to boast of or take confidence in the fact that they have these things that other people don't have, because those things give them certain advantages. But Jeremiah chapter 9, verse 23 and 24 says, "Do not let the wise man glory in his wisdom, nor the mighty man glory in his might, nor the rich man glory in his riches." Now, these are things that people would boast in and find confidence in and, you know, find security in. The wise man in his wisdom, the mighty man in his might, the rich man in his riches. But he says, don't glory in those things. He says, "But let him who glories glory in this, that he understands and knows me," God says, "that I'm the Lord, exercising loving kindness, judgment and righteousness in the earth." So Solomon does recognize that he has much money and much wisdom. He's the wisest man and the richest man of his generation. And he also had large armies, though he never had to fight in any wars. So he had might, he had wisdom, he had riches, all the things that carnal men might lean upon for their security. And, you know, God, through Jeremiah, says, hey, if you got those things, don't lean on those things. Don't boast in those things. Your only security and the only thing that should give you any importance is that you know the Lord. And that's God's perspective on it, whereas Ecclesiastes is just showing, you know, what the world's perspective is on things. So that's what I would see as the significance of those verses.
Okay, so basically wisdom is vanity, although in the worldly sense, although in James 1:5 it does say that if we lack wisdom, we should ask God. So how does that apply in this passage as far as, like, modern context with trying to...
Well, again, the wisdom is a valuable thing. Actually, money is a valuable thing, too. So is power. There's lots of things that people may have to their advantage that are good. But Solomon in Ecclesiastes is searching for the chief good of man under the sun. I mean, that's what the book is about. He had everything money can buy. He had wealth. He had a mansion. He had power. He had armies. He had women more than any other king we know about. He had just about anything that a man might crave for himself. And yet he knew there was something missing because he was away from God. The Bible tells us in 1 Kings chapter 11, he departed from God in his heart. And this book he's writing is telling about the unsatisfied state of a man who has all these things, but he doesn't have God. That's why he says everything is vain under the sun, meaning under the sun means below heaven. Earthly, on the earthly level, there's nothing to provide the true satisfaction and meaning in life that a man needs. Money doesn't, wealth doesn't, power doesn't, wisdom doesn't. That is a reputation for being wise, as he had. You know, reputation doesn't, women don't, booze doesn't. He actually mentions drinking wine and stuff, too. But the idea of the book of Ecclesiastes is to say, hey, I have everything that a man might strive after in the world under the sun without God. But without God, it's emptiness. It provides no satisfaction. And so Ecclesiastes is a treatise on what is man's chief good. What is the chief end of man? And at the end of the book, after he has said again and again about every individual thing he discusses, it's vanity, it's vanity, it's vanity, which in Hebrew means it's emptiness. At the end, he says, at the very last verses of chapter 12, he says, let's hear the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man, and he'll bring every action into judgment. So basically, he's saying, you really can't find the meaning of life in these things under the sun. there's something above the sun, God. There's something in heaven that's not on earth. And following his commandments and living in such a way that's prepared for his judgment is the chief end of man, basically. It's the conclusion of the whole matter, he said. Interestingly, he introduces that by saying, let's hear the conclusion of the matter, as if the whole previous part has been an exploration seeking a conclusion. And that's what it is. You know, as you read through Ecclesiastes, you're not reading a book of moral instructions. You're reading a book by a man who has been and obtained for himself what any carnal man would desire to obtain. But he says, don't bother. I've been there, done there. I got the T-shirt. It's emptiness. Don't go this way. Go another way. And that's what Ecclesiastes is about. Hey, I appreciate your call, but I need to take a break at this point. Thank you for joining us, Brittany. We're going to have another half hour coming up, so don't go away. We have lines open for you if you'd like to be on the air. We haven't had the lines full yet today. The number is 844-484-5737. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or from our website, thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Don't go away.
Everyone is welcome to call The Narrow Path and discuss areas of disagreement with the host. But if you do so, please state your disagreement succinctly at the beginning of your call and be prepared to present your scriptural arguments when asked by the host. Don't be disappointed if you don't have the last word or if your call is cut shorter than you prefer. Our desire is to get as many callers on the air during the short program, so please be considerate to others.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, we have lines open for you. In fact, we have not, in our first half hour, we have not yet had even half of our lines full. Most days we have all the lines full much of the time, so this is a very slow day, a good day for you to get through if you've tried before and found it difficult. The number is 844-484-5737. 844-484-5737. Lorraine from California is our next caller. Welcome.
Thanks
for calling.
Last night I was reading Evidence, The Demands of Verdict.
Uh-huh.
And they made a statement, at least that was my take on it, that the synoptic books in the New Testament were not actually written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. What do you think?
Well, I don't think that's Josh McDowell's opinion.
They were presenting it as somebody's opinion.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, what
that's
you find...
That's how the book is written.
Right. The book of Evidence That Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell is full of quotations from scholars, about different, on making different points. Some of them are better and some are worse, but it's a great book. No, I believe that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the writers of those books.
Okay.
One possible exception is Matthew. We know that Matthew wrote a book, and we have every reason to believe that Matthew is the author of the book of Matthew. There's certainly no better theories about it. But we are told by one of the church fathers named Papias and other fathers afterwards repeated him that Matthew wrote his original book in the Hebrew language, or what he probably meant, Aramaic language, which was his native language, and that others translated it variously. Now, the thing is that when Papias said Matthew wrote his book, he called it the Logia. He wrote the Logia, which apparently means the sayings of Jesus. Now, Matthew's gospel is mostly made up of sayings of Jesus, and maybe that's just the way that Papias was referring to the book of Matthew as we have it now. Or some have thought there might have been an earlier work written in Aramaic by Matthew that just had mostly the sayings of Jesus, and that someone else, or maybe Matthew himself, filled it in with the narrative parts at a later time. And if he wrote in Greek, excuse me, if he wrote in Aramaic, we don't have any Aramaic copies of his writing, but we only have Greek. So it is not possible that while Matthew is the source and his original writings of the sayings of Jesus in Aramaic are the source for the sayings in the book of Matthew, that whoever translated it into Greek may have brought in some other material from Mark or somewhere else, possibly. But I have no difficulty seeing Matthew as the author of the whole work. The thing is that people who say that those men didn't write those books are usually trying to say, we don't know who wrote them, and they probably weren't written in the apostolic age. There are a lot of liberals are trying to say, we can't trust the Gospels because they are a later literary production that were not written until after a lot of verbal traditions had been passed down for maybe a couple generations about Jesus. And then, of course, they like to introduce the idea that where there's verbal traditions passed down, they can be changed. You know, they might not be totally reliable, but they were later written down by people we don't know who they were, and then they were artificially assigned to the names of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as the authors. This theory has exactly zero proof in its favor. What it has against it is that the earliest church fathers, including Papias, who lived right at the end of the apostolic first generation, all the church fathers say Matthew and Mark and John are the writers of those three books. Now, Luke, they believe Luke wrote it too, but I don't think we have quite as early testimony of it. But there's very, very good evidence that Luke wrote it. And if he didn't, there's no explanation for why anyone would say he did, because Luke was not well known outside of the fact that he's considered to be the author of Luke and Acts. He's never mentioned by name in the book of Acts, or he's mentioned by name in a couple of Paul's epistles, just as, the physician who was with him, along with a whole bunch of other people who are named. Luke is, apart from his name being on the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, Luke is one of the most obscure persons mentioned in the Bible. So it's hard to imagine why, if his books were not written by him, that they would have just put his name on them, since he's not that significant. Although if he did write them, that does make him significant, but that's what's up for discussion. So anyway, I personally think that all of those books, the very, very best evidence that can be brought is that they were written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and that there is no alternative theory that has any evidence in its favor. For example, no one has suggested any other names for the authors. Those who say that these men didn't write them, they don't have a theory about any alternative writers. They just say, well, they didn't write them. We don't know who did. Well, really? Well, then you don't have a very strong case. You can't present a case for anybody. But we can present a case for these men, because the early church, who knew these men, did believe they wrote them. I think that would be, if it's not an ironclad case for a skeptic, it certainly is the very best supported by evidence, since no other view has any evidence.
Thank you.
Okay, Lauren. God bless you. Bye now. Okay, that's Lorraine. I think I said Lauren. Okay, we're going to talk to next April from San Bernardino, California. Hi, April. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Good afternoon. Hey, I'm hoping that maybe you could give me some advice on something. When I was young and growing up in Sunday school, a lot of the songs we sang were basically the Psalms put to music. But I find that as an adult, because to help us remember the verse, which is great, but I find as an adult when I'm reading the Psalms and say I come across the passage that we sang, my mind goes there, and it's very distracting because it kind of breaks the flow. Is there any way I can overcome that? Because just the other night I was reading the Psalm, and I was really deep into it, and then suddenly I read the passage that we sang, and it just totally broke the flow. So is there any way I can maybe get over that? Thank you so much.
Well, when you say it broke the flow, you mean it distracted you from the rest of the song because suddenly you were hearing the song in your head? Oh, she's gone? Oh, she hung up. Okay. I assume that's what she meant. And Yeah, I don't know how to get over that. I have to say this. In the Jesus movement, we sang scores of songs that were just directly from the King James Version of the Book of Psalms. And we sang other scripture passages, too, some from the prophets, some from Exodus, certainly some from the New Testament that were just King James Version verses that were put to music. Now, obviously, I have the same experience you're talking about. When I read through the Psalms, I'm constantly hitting passages which I can sing because we put them to music, or somebody did. And I learned it that way. It was a wonderful way, frankly, to learn Scripture. It's a lot easier to memorize Scripture verbatim if you're singing it than to just kind of, you know, memorize by rote. But, I mean, you can do it both ways. But I don't know how to get over it, but I'm not sure why that would be necessary. To me, many of these psalms I learned how to sing before I had ever read the whole psalm that contains these verses. And then when I'd read the Psalms, I'd say, oh, hey, there's that song we sing. But it wasn't a problem. I now saw what the context of it was, which is always helpful to me. I always like to see what context is. So, no, I don't know. To me, it's a little bit like when you've in Sunday school, you hear the story of David and Goliath and of Noah's Ark and of Samson and Delilah and, you know, just different stories like that, crossing the Red Sea. And, you know, as a child, you don't have any context for it. You just know these stories as miscellaneous, isolated, you know, stories. And then when you read through the Bible, you run into these stories. Say, oh, so that's the context of that. I remember the first time reading through the Bible saying, oh, okay, I know that story. And again, in the same sense that the Psalms that you learn to sing, when you encounter them reading through the Psalms, they catch your attention in a special way. You say, oh, I'm familiar with that. I know I can sing that. It's the same thing when you've learned Bible stories as a child and you read through the Bible and you say, oh, I know this story. You know, I don't know the story of the past two chapters, but this one I recognize. I don't really see how that would be an impediment. I can see how, I don't know, you just have to say, okay, so I know how to sing that song, but let's see what the context is here. I'm not sure why that's a problem. I mean, I'm not saying it isn't. If it is a problem to you, then I guess it is. But I'm not sure how that's a problem, which means I'm not sure how to tell you how to remedy it, which is, I think, what you asked me. How can you stop doing that? I don't know, but I can't stop doing that, and I don't really necessarily want to. It's kind of fun to remember singing these psalms when I'm reading them. It kind of makes you feel, oh, I'm in a familiar place. It's sort of like if you're in a foreign country and everyone speaks a language you don't know, and then suddenly you go to a cafe, a Starbucks or something, and there's some people, you know, customers talking in English. You're like, oh, I feel a little more at home at the moment, you know, in a foreign area. And sometimes when everything in the Bible's foreign to you, except the parts that the Bible stories you heard or the songs you learned, hitting those things simply makes you, to me, it's like an oasis, you know, in a desert. Not that the rest of the Bible is a desert to me at all, but it's just a kind of relief and kind of charming to find something that you're familiar with for a change. So I can't help you, but I would say I wouldn't fight that. It doesn't sound to me like something that would be a serious problem. Annie from Marietta, Georgia. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about something that a pastor said once when he was talking about mental health. And he said that Ezekiel and John both seem to have hallucinations that are similar to what would be experienced by someone who has schizophrenia. And I was wondering how that speaks to the credibility of the authors, if that's true.
Well, it isn't true. I mean, they had visions. That's what makes people prophets in the Bible. They have visions. Visions of God, visions of the future, things like that. That's not what the hallucinations that schizophrenics have. Schizophrenics have a mental break from reality. They're seeing things that aren't real, that aren't true. Now, the visions that God gives the prophets are true. They're not yet real because they haven't happened yet, but that's just the point. God is showing them the future. I don't think there's any reason to believe that when a schizophrenic has a hallucination, that they're seeing something that's, although it's not real, it's going to be, unless God's given them a vision and they mistake it for a hallucination. I don't even know that a hallucination and a vision would be experienced the same way by the person having it, but there's certainly a big difference between, kind of a messed up mind imagining that things are happening that are not, on the one hand, and God revealing the future to somebody in a graphic picture. Now, I will say this. I had not heard this about John, though it doesn't surprise me that the same people would say this about John that say it about Ezekiel. In books, in commentaries on Ezekiel, if you read books by somewhat liberal theologians, they often do suggest that Ezekiel might have been mentally ill, that he might have been schizophrenic or something like that, because he did really weird things. Now, the Bible says God told him to do these weird things, and they were symbolic of things he was trying to get across. But, of course, a schizophrenic might think God's telling him to do weird things, too. And so a person who has no respect for the Bible, and that would be liberal scholars to a very large degree, they don't believe that God is revealing things. They don't believe God does reveal things. They don't believe miracles. They don't believe in God's interaction with man in these ways. So obviously they have to think of something and say, wow, okay, this guy thinks God's telling him to do this. Well, if I met a person who thought God was telling him to do that, I think he's a nut. Okay, so I guess I'm going to conclude that Ezekiel's a nut too. Well, that's frankly that appears to be the mental process of many liberal commentators. They don't have real respect for the inspiration of Scripture. They just try to explain everything naturally. They don't believe that God ever revealed the future to anyone because they simply don't believe that's a possibility. And therefore, they suggest that John was having, some kind of a dream or something that came from his own mind about things he hoped would happen, things like that. I'm not even sure why liberals write commentaries on the Bible, since they have no respect for what the Bible actually is. But there's plenty of them out there. The Academy pumps them out. And, the seminaries, many of them are given over totally to liberal scholarship, which means dead scholarship that doesn't have any recognition of the inspiration of Scripture and has to explain everything that is, in fact, supernatural in terms that can be accommodating their naturalistic worldview, which doesn't think there's anything supernatural. So that's, when you find someone saying, well, yeah, I think Ezekiel and John, the visions they had, I think those are like just the same thing as a schizophrenic having hallucinations. Well, that's not how they're represented. And, if Jesus thought that these guys were off track, Ezekiel was off track, then I'd go with that. But Jesus didn't seem to have anything negative to say about the prophets. In fact, he said that the Pharisees should have believed in the law and the prophets. In fact, Jesus said that everything, every jot and tittle in the law and the prophets had to be fulfilled. Well, Ezekiel was one of the prophets, so everything in Ezekiel has to be fulfilled. Well, why would that be true if the guy's just having hallucinations? Jesus obviously took the prophets of the Old Testament at face value, as conservative Christians do. But conservative Christians dwell in a religious environment where there's also not believing people who are Bible teachers, scholars, and pastors. They teach at seminaries and they lead churches and they don't believe the Bible's true. I remember my dad, when he was working, one thing he did, he worked for Edison Company, one thing he did, he used to drive groups of people up to see the power plants and give them tours of them. And sometimes he'd take a suburban full of pastors. And this on this drive, they'd talk a lot. My dad was a Christian, so he'd raise, especially talking to pastors, raise issues. And he was always surprised to see how many pastors didn't believe the Bible. I mean, they were upfront about it. They said, oh, we just don't believe that. And I remember he told me that when I was a kid, and I thought, why in the world would they teach the Bible if they don't believe the Bible? And that is a good question. Either they think they can do some kind of secular good for man by somehow leading churches and schools, or they're trying to undermine faith in the Bible in the religious community. I don't know, but I wouldn't I wouldn't give any value to a book on Ezekiel that said that he was having hallucinations. All right, let's talk to Justine from Connecticut. Justine, welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Steve, I have a question regarding Genesis 6:2.
Mm-hmm.
It said something about the
sons
fallen angels.
No,
yes.
No, it says sons of God.
Yes, sons of God.
Yeah, it doesn't mention angels, yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought it read sons of God, and it doesn't refer to the falling angels? No.
Well, there are some who think so, but I don't. I mean,
there's no reason
to believe it does. The term sons of God is a term that's used a variety of ways in the Bible. I mean, Jesus is called the Son of God. We're called sons of God in the New Testament. Israel were called God's sons in the Old Testament. Sons of God can often mean just people who are, you know, godly, who are loyal to God. Now, but also sons of God may mean angels at times, although I've never read of any passage where it spoke of fallen angels, but in Job chapter 1 and 2, the sons of God are conferring before the Lord. And later on in Job, near the end, it says that the sons of God sang for joy when God laid the foundations of the earth. So, I mean, they must be probably referring to the angels, but in these cases, not the fallen angels. So we don't have any reference in the Bible where the sons of God, the term is used where it's likely to mean fallen angels. Sons of God, the vast majority of times in the Bible that term is used, refers to people, godly people. So that's how I would take it in Genesis 6:2. There's a lot of people who see it the way you think it. There's a lot of people who think that, you know, demons or fallen angels came down and, you know, raped women and had children by them, and these children were the Nephilim. But anyone who reads that passage through that lens needs to say, well, what if I read that passage without that lens? What might it say? Well, it might say that godly people began to marry women who were not their spiritual equals. These were interfaith marriages, people who were not godly women. And they had children. And because these were interfaith marriages rather than, strictly speaking, godly marriages, these children, as is so often the case when the mother and the father have different religious standards or moral standards, the children often go with the most slack standards and follow the parent who's not very godly. So the world became evil. Now, the Bible says God saw that the iniquity of men was great on the earth, it says, and the thoughts of and imaginations of their hearts were only evil continually. And God said, my spirit will not always strive with men. So he didn't mention any angels here. He's talking about men. The problem is caused by men. And now it does say there were Nephilim, which is usually translated giants, in the earth in those days. But it doesn't say that they came from those marriages. In fact, it seems to say they did not come from those marriages, because it says there were Nephilim in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God went into the daughters of men and children were born to them. So there were Nephilim apparently before and also after those marriages took place. And there's no suggestion that those marriages produced the Nephilim. So I realize you've probably have heard the same thing that lots of people have heard, a very popular view out there that, you know, demons or fallen angels came and had children with women. That is not what it says. That's what many people read into it. I think the first person we know of to read that meaning into it was whoever wrote the Book of Enoch. The Book of Enoch was written a couple hundred years before Christ by somebody pretending to be the prophet Enoch, but not really him. It's an anonymous work as far as who the real authorship is. But that the idea that these sons of God were angels and married humans seems to originate with Enoch, the Book of Enoch, a couple centuries before Christ. So a lot of people like it, like that theory. It's kind of science fictionish, kind of sexy, kind of gross. But it's popular with many people. I don't particularly see any reason to hold to that view. All right. Rebecca from Hawaii, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Aloha, Steve. Aloha from Hawaii. I need your help in finding reference and how to know that we're no longer governed by the Old Testament and rather governed by the New.
Okay.
You know, the, you
well,
know, it's
let,
like,
let me direct you somewhere.
Before is okay now, and tithing and not tithing now, and I mean, what reference do we have for all of that?
Okay, well, we've got a lot of reference to that. The first thing I would point out is that Moses and Elijah, representing the law and the prophets, appeared on a mountain with Jesus and with three of the disciples. And the disciples wanted to retain them all. He said, Peter said, let's make three tents, one for Moses, one for Elijah, one for Jesus. We'll stay around here. And then the two men who were there with Jesus, Moses and Elijah, they disappeared. And only Jesus was left. And God spoke from heaven and said, this is my son, hear him. Now, these disciples were Jewish. They'd always heard the law and the prophets at the synagogue. That was always the authority for the Jews under the Old Testament. But now the Old Testament has passed, and that's symbolized by Moses and Elijah passing. And when only Jesus was left, God emphasizes, this is my son, listen to him. That is, instead of Moses and Elijah. Now, this is also reflected in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, which says, God, who at sundry times and diverse manners spoken to our fathers through the prophets, has spoken in these last days through his Son, who is the express image of his person and the bright shining of his glory. So he says, in the old times, God spoke through the Old Testament people. And the whole book of Hebrews, if you read through it, teaches that the law, the sacrifices, Moses, even the promised land, all those things that were so important in the Old Testament, they're all types, and they're all inferior to Christ himself, which is who we follow now. Now, Paul, in Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 4, basically said that the law was like a husband, but that marriage we had to the law, which is a covenant. The point he's making is marriage is a covenant, and the law was a covenant, the old covenant. It says a woman is bound to her husband, but not after he's dead. And he says that marriage has ended because we've died with Christ, and now we're free to marry another, which is him that's risen from the dead, Christ, he says in verse 4. And so the idea is there was an earlier marriage to the law in the old covenant, but now that covenant, our relationship with it is over. We died with Christ, and that ends that marriage, that covenant. And now we enter into a new covenant with Christ, a new marriage. And so, you know that if you have a second marriage, let's just say a woman marries a man, and they have a good marriage and everything like that, but she's very obedient, submissive to all his desires, but then he dies. Well, she doesn't have to do anything. Her husband said after that, she's a widow. She's not under his rule. But she might marry another man, and he might want her to do certain things too, and if she's obedient, submissive husband, she'll do those. Some of the things might be the same things her first husband wanted her to do. Some may not be. But the whole thing is she's not living her life with reference to anything her first husband required. She now has a new husband. The new covenant she made with a new man dominates her reality and supersedes any old covenant she had with her first husband. So that's how Paul describes our relationship with the law and so forth. It's not the only place. Paul talks about this great deal in Galatians also, and in other places in Romans. There's quite a lot, but I can't give you any more than that. But I do have a series of lectures about Torah observance, which you might be interested in, at thenarrowpath.com under the topic of lectures. Unfortunately, I'm out of time. I can't go any further with that today, but I've spoken a lot about it in a lot of my lectures. You can check our website, thenarrowpath.com. We are listener-supported. The Narrow Path is. You can donate at the website or just take free whatever is there, thenarrowpath.com.